KXNO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. There's new information about the man who carried out the New Year's attack on New Orleans' Bourbon Street. FBI Special Agent Lionel Merthel says Shamsuddin Jabbar scouted out his targets during visits there in October and November.
He was in town at least 2 days. During that time, Jabbar, using Meta glasses, recorded a video as he rode through the French Quarter on a bicycle.
President Biden will visit with family members of the 14 people killed when he goes to New Orleans tomorrow. FlightAware says there are more than 3,700 delays now, nearly 1,200 flight cancellations in the U.S. due to the huge snow and ice storm. That storm now stretches from Nebraska and Kansas into the mid-Atlantic. National Weather Service meteorologist Frank Pereira.
We're looking at amounts on the order of 18 to 14 inches from portions of the Central Plains, Mid-Mississippi Valley, all the way over to the Appalachians.
With tens of millions of people in the path of that storm, shelters are opening up for homeless people and those who might lose power and heat. WBNS-TV's Carla Rogner is in chilly Columbus, Ohio, where it's 25 degrees.
At Third Shift Shelter, staff is making sure the heat is working and the boxes of blankets are full. Owner Jasmine Franklin says they're ready to keep people warm through the snowstorm.
We have a lot of donations of blankets that's been given out all the time. At night, we give them extra blankets in the mornings when they're leaving.
The farewell to America's 39th president has brought older and younger Americans to his library to pay respects.
I'm Jim Crisul in Atlanta, with a military honor guard standing vigil over his flag-draped coffin. The body of former President Jimmy Carter now lies in repose at the Carter Presidential Center. 16-year-old Owen Bowers came with his parents to pay tribute to Mr. Carter.
He's special to me because he's from Georgia, and he can prove that anyone can do whatever they want in their life. And he tackled a lot of issues people think he couldn't handle.
Mr. Carter's body will remain here until Tuesday morning, when it will be flown to Washington, D.C. for an official state funeral Thursday. Jim Crisul, CBS News, Atlanta.
Hamas has reportedly approved a list of 34 hostages presented by Israel to be exchanged in a possible ceasefire deal. Reuters says the deal depends on agreement for a permanent ceasefire and for the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Prime Minister Netanyahu has just said that report's not true and Hamas has not provided any list. CBS's Linda Gradstein has an update on the hostages.
Some 100 Israeli hostages remain in Gaza, both alive and dead. Incoming President Trump has warned there will be all hell to pay if the hostages are not released by his inauguration.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Brittany Merlot with WXCO News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section on the WXCO website at BullFallsRadio.com.
As the new year begins, activists are asking lawmakers and officials to figure out how to prevent school shootings, like the one that happened just weeks ago in Madison. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
While Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has called for a holistic approach, advocates say prevention starts with stronger gun laws. Lindsay Nichols with the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence says the state could require universal background checks for gun purchases or raise the age for gun possession.
We know that some of these shooters are young people themselves. And there are plenty of policies, for example, to keep guns out of the hands of youth. These are laws that some states have passed and some haven't. We need action from our lawmakers to protect our kids.
She says other options are to pass a red flag law or strengthen legislation on firearm storage. Giffords ranks states on a scorecard for their gun laws every year. Wisconsin most recently received a C grade. Nichols says time and again, they found the stronger a state's gun laws, the lower its gun death rate. And the weaker the laws, the higher the gun death rate.
We know that these gun laws work, and there really is no reason why legislators shouldn't be taking action to prevent these tragedies.
While Wisconsin has enacted basic gun safety laws, she notes the state could also pass bans on assault weapons or high-capacity magazines or lengthen the waiting period for a firearms purchase. Despite public pressure for new gun safety laws in 2020, Wisconsin has not passed any significant gun legislation in years. Democrats have tried unsuccessfully to introduce at least 30 gun safety measures since 2019. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine today. Highs in the upper teens, but thanks to north and northwest winds nearly to 20 miles per hour, our wind chills will be between 5 and 15 below. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, lows in the upper single digits. It's 12 at our studios.
Dom Salvia.
Next time, it's Monday, so our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay, will join us. Plus, it's January 6th. The counting and certification of the electoral vote is scheduled to take place. Tune in. We'll be wild.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, Wausau's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host on this broadcast, on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Delighted to have you joining me and my terrific producer, Max, here in the studios of Civic Media. We are once again this weekend pursuing our weekly review, our analysis, our assessment of those major news stories in the areas of law and government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America and beyond as well. We often take a look at matters overseas in the international arena as well. This weekend's broadcast, no exception to that commission. As always, we take our name from the word amicus, sometimes pronounced amicus. Either one of those is acceptable. That's the Latin. That's the legal term that means friend. Friend of the court, amicus curiae. And indeed, once again, we're going to be talking about a specific news story this week that highlights that language because the amicus brief of the incoming president once again in the news this past week when it comes to TikTok. We'll get to that story in just a few moments. As always, taking your inquiries and taking your questions here at Civic Media at 855-752-4842. That number, once again, is 855-752-4842. You can also drop a comment, a question into the Civic Media line, and we will take that up. Be a part of our discussion. Be a part of our engagement on these important issues. This, the first news story, the news events of the week, in this first broadcast of 2025, honored to have you with me, choosing to spend some of your weekend with us here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. What is the syllabus? What is our agenda on this weekend's program, the first one in 2025? Again, we're going to spend much of our time in these first segments talking about some critical news stories that happened just this past week. We begin, of course, with the horrific event in New Orleans and the law enforcement attempt not only to make sense, if that is ever possible, of this heinous crime, this heinous event that has shaken not only the citizens of New Orleans, the victims, now 14 in number, people who have died, many others injured, the victims, of course, the entire community, the entire state of Louisiana, all of us in the United States of America suffering in the wake of this horrific event there in New Orleans. Lots of law enforcement things to talk about down the road as the law enforcement authorities, yes, led by the FBI, that's identified that as an instance of domestic violence. Domestic terrorism, in particular, that has a particular definition under the Federal Criminal Code. That's no small appellation. That's no small categorization of this investigation, because what it means is it's animated by an attempt to create terror, to disrupt the basic norms and practices of the community, of the government, of people in general. Indeed, that's what this investigation seems to be indicating. At the same time, we send not only our concerns and our support to the people of Louisiana and to New Orleans, but of course the families of those victims, as families of the victims of the event itself. And as we continue here on this broadcast and others of Civic Media, we'll report on specifically the findings coming out of that, more about the individual who undertook that heinous event and the reasons why, as it begins the calendar year 2025. It provides us with some insight into the dangerous nature of the world in which we live, including our nation, and the possibility, the likelihood, regrettably, of more violence in the coming year. Not only domestic violence of that kind, domestic terrorism of that kind, but also, as we have spoken at great length on this broadcast, about gun violence as well, other forms of violence that mar our social compact and undermine our safety and security. In the last portion of our broadcast this weekend, we're going to spend some time talking about the top 15 rule of law events that we can anticipate in 2025 reasonably. Among those, regrettably, is continued judicial review and judicial assessment, but also regrettably, a focus upon the effects of gun violence in America. That's one of the 15 that we will talk about among 14 others in the last segments in the second hour of our broadcast this weekend. The top 15 rule of law events likely to happen, certainly subject to lots of change during the course of the next weeks and months. But the top 15 rule of law events in 2025, that is going to animate the second portion of our broadcast this weekend. Closing out our broadcast is going to be some time in reflection, and in particular thinking about what begins today, which is this weekend, the removal, the movement of the body of the former president, Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States of America, from the hospital just outside of Plains, Georgia, moving eventually to other locations in Georgia so that people in that state and beyond can pay their respects to this amazing man, this amazing president. Ultimately, next week on both Tuesday and Thursday, lying in state and the capital of the United States of America, and then on the 9th, a major event at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., in anticipation of all of that, beginning this weekend as the Carter motorcade leaves the hospital en route to his boyhood farm, as a part of the movement of his body, the movement of his spirit across America. I'm just spending some time talking about my own connection with Jimmy Carter. I was an intern, a staff intern, in the summer of 1980. Provide some reflections on his presidency, sometimes wildly understated, and focusing in particular upon his focus upon health care and also education and environment, things that are sometimes overlooked as we emphasize his post-presidency, which was undeniably, stunningly remarkable. But nonetheless, we sometimes forget about the major things that Jimmy Carter did during his presidency for the people of the United States of America, spending some time in the last moments of our broadcast this Saturday talking about Jimmy Carter, this icon in America who deserves all of the reverential historical support and remembrance that we can possibly provide this weekend and beyond, as we think about the legacy that he leaves to all of us in America. And also as we look forward, of course, to the inauguration of a next president, President Donald Trump, who could not be more different in ways big, small, and in between. And we're going to begin our review of major news stories talking about Donald Trump in particular. We're going to talk about a major story coming out of New York. That is decision of Juan Merchan, who is the presiding judge over that hush money trial, that fraudulent claims, that fraudulent statements case in which Donald Trump was found guilty, 34 counts of violations of New York law. He remains to this day, and likely will remain at the time of his inauguration, a convicted felon, because the judge who's presiding over that case, Juan Merchan, has indicated that In about 5-6 days from now, the court will entertain the sentencing of the defendant in that Manhattan courtroom. We'll talk about what Judge Juan Merchan has said already in resolving a number of pre-sentencing things. Couldn't be doing some exposition of what Juan Merchan wrote just on Friday of this past week. And then we're also going to talk necessarily about another situation involving Donald Trump's presence in the legal community inside courts in America, the loss this past week of an appeal that he took of one of E. Jean Carroll's civil judgments, the $5 million judgment against him that was found by a jury. We'll talk about what an appeals court did in the state of New York just this past week as well. Necessarily going to be moving on to other matters having to do with judges and courts in America. Just this past week, the Sixth Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, these major states just to the east of us here in the United States of America, the Sixth Circuit, finding that the net neutrality as established under the Biden administration and under the Federal Communications Commission cannot stand, overturning the concept of net neutrality when it comes to communications in the public domain. We'll talk about what that means. And in particular, the decision by that three-judge panel to adopt what the Supreme Court permitted them to do, which is dropkick deference to an agency. You may recall well the dropping of that Chevron deference just this past summer. It has an impact, and indeed, the Sixth Circuit just this past week invoking its newfound freedom, if you will, to do whatever it wants and to deny the expertise and the experience and the foundation of people who know what they're talking about inside these agencies, including the FCC, overturning net neutrality, at least for now. That may well be on the court's docket down the road, the Supreme Court docket, but again, dependent a lot upon what happens as that litigation is further pursued. Necessarily need to go overseas once again because South Korea continues to be in the rule of law news of our nation and of the world. South Korea once again reeling in the wake of that very, very inappropriate decision by its former president to impose martial law in early December. Again, once again in the news just this past week and these past several days, not only as the citizenry responds to those efforts of the current president to remain in power and opposition leaders, of course, to keep him out, but a standoff, if you will, just this weekend anticipated by the issuance of an arrest warrant for the current president there. We'll talk about what that means and what the future of the South Korean government may hold in 2025. And finally, in the area of important news from this past week, once again, TikTok in the news, as I indicated. President Trump not only providing his own amicus brief in that connection, but saying something about his status at the time that he filed that brief that we're going to highlight as a part of all that. The oral argument, of course, on the TikTok issue, whether or not it will remain a viable entity, whether you can go on TikTok, produce TikTok videos and other communications. That coming up for the United States Supreme Court in just a few days on the 10th of January. That, of course, is the same day that Donald Trump is scheduled to be sentenced in that Manhattan court. We're also going to spend a little bit of time talking about other things on the docket of the United States Supreme Court into January so that you know about the almost 30 cases additionally it's going to be hearing oral argument on as January becomes February and moves into March. All of that, of course, anticipating decisions, some very significant decisions in a number of different areas, those coming up probably in May and June, maybe July of this year. All of that is on Amicus, a law review, our weekend review. As always, encouraging you to be in touch with me and Max. That number once again is 855-752-4842 as we continue here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
Falls Radio, WXCO.
Hey, it's me time at Chula Vista. Time for you to pamper yourself. Wisconsin's most complete resort experience has everything you want. Fine-tuned for 70 years by four generations of the Kaminsky family, Chula Vista can be easygoing with colorful scenic river walks, 18 holes of classic golf, a relaxing spa, or you can go all out in 80,000 square feet of indoor water park. Zip lining through canyon views in Chula's Aerial Adventure Park. And dining comes any way you like it. From pizza to Wisconsin's number one ranked steakhouse. More than 600 guest rooms to choose from with $10 million in updates. Chula Vista, everything you've been wanting, all right here on site. Check it out at ChulaVistaResort.com.
USA Today's Reader's Choice Awards named Chula Vista one of America's top 10 indoor water parks. Find out why at ChulaVistaResort.com.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio WXCO, Wausau's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. It is our weekly weekend review of all things justice-related, government-related, rule of law-related, beginning with commentary and reporting on a week for Donald Trump, anticipating, of course, his own inauguration on the 20th of this month. This past week, providing him with some reason to be concerned about where he stands in legal matters in which he's been involved in recent years. Early in the week, President-elect Donald Trump failed to overturn that $5 million judgment that was entered previously in this previous year that he sexually abused E. Jean Carroll. She is a writer. She is a person who has been published in many different areas, allegedly abusing her in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room in the mid-1990s, later defaming her. Donald Trump's lawyers had argued to a federal appeals court, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that a lower court in that case on those claims in Manhattan had erred in the course of the trial in allowing two women to testify in that trial, that he had also sexually assaulted them. This is called prior bad acts, the kinds of things that judges rule on all the time in evidentiary matters. Those lawyers for Donald Trump had also argued that the court should not have allowed E. Jean Carroll's lawyers during the course of that trial to play the recording of that infamous Access Hollywood conversation, that tape. We regrettably all remember too well. Mr. Trump at that time, of course, bragged in very vulgar terms about women and his treatment of them. The appeals court just this past week, early this past week, rejecting Donald Trump's request for a new trial, saying that Donald Trump has not demonstrated that the district court erred in any of these challenge rulings. That, of course, coming out from the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. An unsigned order, but issued by three judges. Their names are Denny Chin and Susan Carney and also Myrna Perez. Both E. Jean Carroll and I are gratified by today's decision. That's Roberta Kaplan, who is E. Jean Carroll's attorney, said, "We thank the Second Circuit for its careful consideration of the party's arguments." Needless to say, the spokesman for Donald Trump had different response to this decision by the Court of Appeals. He said that the president had received an overwhelming mandate, said that the American people, as a result of that, demand an immediate end to the political weaponization of our justice system, swift dismissal of all these witch hunts, including the Democrat-funded E. Jean Carroll hoax, which will continue to be appealed. Apparently going to pursue this, or at least try to appeal this, to the United States Court, to the United States Supreme Court, which is where it would go from the Second Circuit. The federal jury there had also found that Donald Trump defamed E. Jean Carroll when he wrote on his social media posts that the case was a complete con job, called this a lie, called this a hoax. And again, the jury imposing a damage judgment of $5 million. That's in addition to a Manhattan jury in another case, much related, in which a jury ordered Ms. Carroll to receive $83.3 million for Donald Trump's defaming her in 2019. Again, after she accused him of rape and continued to do so in his social media posts. All of this, of course, is Donald Trump stunningly, shockingly, inappropriately, our incoming president says that he believes that E. Jean Carroll should go to jail. He writes, "Should a woman go to jail for falsely accusing a man for rape And the post encouraging others to post and share the post if you want justice for Donald Trump. Wildly inappropriate, inconsistent with our basic norms of justice in America. He certainly has the right to pursue appeals, but that kind of thing, that notion that we would criminally find that a defendant who is pursuing, a plaintiff who is pursuing against a defendant in this case, her legitimate claims supported by juries that have found, again, by a preponderance of the evidence that those claims are legitimate. Those kinds of claims, those kinds of allegations that E. Jean Carroll therefore should go to jail for all of this, again, wildly inconsistent, inappropriate, should be condemned as we do, even as Donald Trump begins to head toward his presidency in just a couple of weeks. A second major thing happened in connection with Donald Trump's litigation of this past week, that E. Jean Carroll matter, both of those cases, of course, those are civil in nature, civil judgments of $5 million and $83 million. Donald Trump, as we all well know, also convicted in May of 2024, over 6 months ago, of violating New York law, 34 different counts, felony counts of violating the false statements and fraudulent representations mandates of New York law. A jury there once again finding beyond a reasonable doubt unanimously that Donald Trump had done these things. Donald Trump remains to this time a convicted felon. And indeed, the judge who is presiding over this case, his name is Juan Merchan. We've talked about him a lot. Juan Merchan this past week, late this past week, said he is going to now, thankfully proceed to bring this matter to conclusion, at least at the trial court level, by doing what? Doing what every other case contemplates after a defendant is found guilty by a jury or by a court. And that is a sentencing proceeding. The judges in our system uniquely positioned, as the judge says in his particular order here, to decide what should happen with this defendant. And indeed, that is what he has announced on Friday of this past week and presumably will reaffirm on the next Friday, on December 10th. Again, an important day in the jurisprudence of America, a major historic event next Friday in the history of our nation. At that time, Juan Merchan has said that after months and months of delays, you may recall sentencing first scheduled in July, then September, then November, and then just taken off the calendar completely, now finally scheduled for December 10th. At that time, the judge is finally going to impose a sentence, which is a part of the normal process. And we should applaud that not only because of the appropriateness under the rule of law, because it does provide some conclusion once again, at least to the district court level. It is likely that in the days and weeks and months ahead that Donald Trump, through his counsel, and he has the right to pursue this, could pursue even an appeal of that judgment that the court enters this coming Friday. Nonetheless, it's clear that Juan Merchan has signaled what he is going to do. Somewhat peculiar in terms of a process here. Normally, the judges schedule sentencings of defendants and hear them out. Hear out the prosecution, hear out the defense, including what's called a right of allocution. A right of allocution, the defendant addressing the judge, telling the judge what he or she thinks should happen in his or her case. The judge has already signaled that he's not going to impose any jail time, no real penalties in this case. We'll get to that in just a moment or so. Nonetheless, calling Donald Trump into court, sort of. He has said that Donald Trump can either appear in person or can appear remotely. Again, an accommodation not afforded a lot of other defendants in the state and federal courts of America. But calling him in either virtually or in person to be sentenced in about a week or so at the end of this coming week. Along the way, the judge issued a major decision and order. It is 18 pages long, and we're not going to read every single portion of it, but just some excerpts of it because it underscores this judge's perhaps penultimate discussion of this case in particular. Plainly, at the time of the sentencing, we suspect that Judge Merchan will say other things about the case, about the trial, about Donald Trump's behavior. Along the way, in his written decision announcing the sentencing of this coming week, Judge Merchan says this. He says, having addressed and resolved all matters brought before this court and the verdict now more than a half year behind us, yes, indeed, it's taken a long time, all that remains outstanding is the issuance of a decision and the imposition of sentence. As we continue here on Amicus Law Review, we'll talk more about Juan Merchan said about that imposition of sentence in his major order of just this past week. Stay with us for that decision and that reporting.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
CBS News Brief. The FBI says the New Orleans attacker scouted the French Quarter on a bicycle with glasses that could record everything. Special Agent Lionel Myrtle.
Jabbar was wearing a pair of Meta glasses when he conducted the attack on Bourbon Street, but he did not activate the glasses to live stream his actions that day.
President Biden goes to New Orleans tomorrow. New Yorkers are now paying a toll to drive south of 60th Street in Manhattan. The official reason? Try to get more drivers to use mass transit. Not everyone believes that.
Too much. It's a money grab. It's got nothing to do with congestion. It's all about getting money.
New Senate Majority Leader John Thune tells CBS's Face the Nation he thinks Congress is ready to act on the Trump agenda quickly, even with a slim majority in the House.
These are unusual circumstances with respect to the margins, particularly in the House. But we expect to deliver on what the American people asked us to do.
CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Another loss at home for the Bucks. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks losing to the Portland Trail Blazers 105-102. Milwaukee had the lead with under a minute to play, but let it slip away. The Bucks have now lost four of their last five games to teams with records below 500. Head coach Doc Rivers.
It's frustrating watching us play, you know, and it's on both ends. Defensively, we're getting beat off the dribble over and over again, getting beat off the glass. Offensively, I don't see us playing with much pace. We're not getting in the paint much. We're not playing in the house. We had a beautiful stretch. I think it was the beginning of the fourth. We didn't make any of the shots, and that's who we are.
The Bucks head to Toronto to play the Raptors tomorrow night. The Wisconsin Badgers hockey teams competed in the Frozen Confines tournament held at Wrigley Field. The women skated to a 3-3 tie against Ohio State, the men losing in overtime 4-3 to Michigan State. NFL, Packers hosting the Bears. We'll have a recap of the game tonight. The Packers placing Jair Alexander on IR after having knee surgery last Tuesday. With sports, on Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine today. Highs in the upper teens, but thanks to north and northwest winds nearly to 20 miles per hour, our wind chills will be between 5 and 15 below. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, lows in the upper single digits. It's 12 at our studios.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In November 2022, Michigan voters passed a constitutional amendment enshrining voting protections and expanding ballot access. After the legislature implemented the voters' directive, GOP legislators sued, claiming that only the legislature could make such changes. Proposition 2 mandated 9 days of early voting, protections for voters and election workers from harassment, and a tracking system for absentee ballots. It allowed for the funding of secure drop boxes and the counting of military and overseas ballots if postmarked by Election Day, and several other reforms. Conjuring the independent state legislature theory, which argues that the U.S. Constitution allows only legislatures to control election law, 11 Michigan GOP legislators sued. On December 20th, the Federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the lower court's denial of the Michigan legislators' claim. But importantly, it did so saying that while the individual legislators had no standing to bring the case, a full legislature could, leaving the door open a crack. The U.S. Supreme Court mostly dismissed the theory in 2023's Moore v. Harper case, but Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito appear to be all in on the theory. For the moment, the pro-voter reforms in Michigan are safe, but be watching for the independent state legislature theory to pop up again soon. We have the decision at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Jane Mattenair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we'll recap the weekend's news, and we bring back Beyond the Cheese. Wisconsin knitwear is featured. Don't miss it.
Mattenair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. I am your host this hour and next hour as well here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This is Amicus, a law review, beginning our discussion about the continued legal entanglements, legal issues facing our incoming President Donald Trump, focusing right now upon a major decision issued by the presiding judge in that New York case in which Donald Trump was adjudged guilty. 34 counts. He is a convicted felon under New York law for violating New York law. False statements, false representations in connection with payments, about $130,000 to Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet about a sexual event, an affair that Donald Trump and she had prior to the 2016 election. And for that reason, in many ways presented by the prosecutors, by the DA, his name is Alvin Bragg there in Manhattan, as an election interference case, which, of course, there are others of that nature as well that were out there for a long period of time, too. In the course of presiding over this trial, the judge, of course, had a front row seat, not only of the testimony and the documents and all the behaviors going on. He talks a lot about that in his 18-page order issued late this past week. Before he even gets to that, however, he says some other things about the importance of scheduling sentencing, again, as a way of bringing this to conclusion, that rule of law notion. He says all that remains outstanding is the issuance of this decision and the imposition of sentence. Nothing more to do, and he is right about that. Scheduling sentencing is a function, he provides this civics instruction, is a function that remains exclusive within the purview of the trial judge and can be easily set down for a date and a time certain to minimize disruption and inconvenience, provided that applicable statutory obligations are met. That's his way of saying nothing about what he's going to do, which is scheduling this matter for sentencing, is going to obstruct the process of Donald Trump anticipating in this transition period his own presidency. The defendant, he says, Donald Trump, argues that Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's decision to dismiss the defendant's federal indictments is evidence of a mandate that all criminal cases pending against the president-elect must cease immediately. In other words, because Jack Smith has abandoned the Department of Justice dismissing those cases involving federal election interference and the documents case coming out of South Florida, because the federal government has abandoned those somewhat related but nonetheless disconnected cases, so too, judge, you should do this. The judge has a very simple response to that. He said the vastly different procedural posture of the present case renders any comparison to the special counsel's indictments unpersuasive. That's probably some of his lighter argument. Indeed, it's clear that Judge Juan Merchan is taking this opportunity to give the defendant, to give his counsel, to give the prosecution, to give the worldwide community, including people in New York, including here in Wisconsin, a sense of his own view of this case. He talks about the decisions that he's previously rendered, finding that indeed those immunity decisions and the other prosecutions do not impact this case, which was not official in capacity, private conduct by the defendant. He says it would be an abuse of discretion for the court to create or recognize any new forms of presidential immunity in the absence of legal authority, sort of a pre-indictment, a pre-presidential indictment, presidential immunity, that doesn't flow, he says, from the United States Supreme Court. The defendant, he says, has presented no valid argument to convince this court otherwise. Binding precedent does not provide that an individual, upon becoming president, can retroactively dismiss or vacate prior criminal acts. Nor does it grant blanket presidential elect immunity. There's no such concept, he says. The court is therefore forbidden from recognizing either form of immunity. He goes on to talk about something called the Clayton Memorandum, which is under New York law, some factors that a court should consider in determining whether to grant a motion to dismiss in the interest of justice. He identifies all of those. And I commend to your reading, commend to your attention, pages 9 and 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 of the order, because he goes through them in great detail. Even in these last days of this prosecution, the pendency of this case in front of the judge giving Donald Trump appropriate attention. He says here, 12 jurors unanimously found the defendant guilty of 34 counts of falsifying business records with the intent to defraud. He's talking about the impact of this jury verdict. That included an intent to commit or conceal a conspiracy to promote a presidential election by unlawful means. That's describing exactly what the jury found here. And then goes on to say this, just so there's no mistaking, he said, it was the premeditated and continuous deception by the leader of the free world that is the gravamen of this offense. Those are no small words, no shrinking from the significance of this case. He says to vacate this verdict on the grounds that the charges are insufficiently serious, given the position the defendant once held, is about to assume once again, would constitute a disproportionate result and cause immeasurable damage to the citizenry confidence in the rule of law. He goes on to say, as to the allegation that Michael Cohen, you recall Michael Cohen, who is the fixer for Donald Trump, testified on behalf of the prosecution about the ways in which Donald Trump orchestrated these payments, falsified these records. A lot of the testimony, again, premised upon his particular intimate involvement with Donald Trump as his lawyer, his advisor, his fixer. Michael Cohen testified in the course of that trial. Juan Merchan takes this opportunity to talk about the attacks that Donald Trump has made on Michael Cohen. He says, as to the allegation that Michael Cohen provided unreliable, perjured testimony, this court presided over the entire trial and sat mere feet from all the witnesses who testified. In doing so, this court had an opportunity to listen to their testimony and to observe their demeanor, and therefore to form an opinion as to their credibility. Again, typically reserved for the jury, but here again the judge says, no, I determined some credibility issues here as well. Having done so, it does not agree. The court does not agree with the defendant's characterization of Mr. Cohen's testimony. Moreover, a total of 22 witnesses, underscoring the significance of all of the evidence here, 22 witnesses, the judge reminds us, testified at trial, 500 exhibits admitted, all of which supported the jury's verdict. The claim of the defendant, of Donald Trump, to the contrary, does not weigh in his favor. Goes on to say, the defendant's unrelenting and unsubstantiated attacks against the integrity and the legitimacy of the legal process, individual prosecutors, witnesses, and the rule of law. This court has refrained from commenting thereupon unless required to do so as when ruling on motions for contempt of court. However, the judge now says, this defendant, by virtue of the present motion, directly asks this court to consider his character as a basis to vacate the jury verdict, and this court must do so in accordance with the requirements of this Clayton motion, the standards in New York law, and says this, the defendant's disdain for the third branch of government, that's the judiciary, whether state or federal, in New York or elsewhere, is a matter of public record. These are no small words coming from the trial judge here. He says, defendant has gone to great lengths to broadcast on social media and other forums his lack of respect for judges and juries, grand juries, and the justice system as a whole. In this case, despite repeated admonitions, this court was left with no choice but to find the defendant guilty of 10 counts of contempt for his repeated violations of this court's order restraining extrajudicial statements. Recall those well. Findings which the defendant mean that the defendant willingly ignored the lawful mandates of this court, an order which the defendant continues to attack as unlawful and unconstitutional, despite the fact that it has been challenged and upheld by the appellate division, the appellate courts here in New York, no less than 8 times. Judge Merchan goes on to write, indeed, as defendant must surely now know, the same order was left undisturbed by the United States Supreme Court. You went up there, Mr. Trump, and they didn't give you the relief you wanted either. Defendant continues to undermine its legitimacy, the court's legitimacy, its posts, in posts to millions of followers. Indeed, this is not the only instance in which Donald Trump has been held in contempt or sanctioned by a court. Defendant's character and history vis-a-vis the rule of law and the third branch of government must be analyzed under this factor in direct relation to the result he seeks, and in that vein, it does not weigh in his favor. Goes on at great length to talk about the demerits, the lack of substance in Donald Trump's position based upon his behavior, his contempt for the rule of law, his contempt for judges and prosecutors and juries and witnesses. He comments about that in a way that he's never commented before. Goes on to say that defendant somehow argues that a dismissal here will improve public confidence in the criminal justice system because anything short of a full dismissal will interfere with his presidency. Says this court's perspective is different. There is an understatement for you from Juan Merchan. To begin, the defendant claims the New York County jury pool was tainted and that he was unable to select an impartial jury. Defendant raised the same issue previously in a motion for further adjournment based upon alleged prejudicial pretrial publicity. What defendant is asking this court to do, Juan Merchan says, is to assume that the jurors who self-identified as truthful, those who remained were not truthful. That conclusion is illogical, entirely unsupported, and therefore the record is devoid of any instances during voir dire, which is the process of selecting those jurors that Mr. Trump now condemns, which lasted 4 days, the judge reminds us, of defendant asking jurors whether they'd been exposed to any extrajudicial statements by anybody involved in this case. The judge dismissing this notion that somehow the jurors who were on the panel lied and those who were not on the panel, those told the truth, and therefore everything should be thrown out. Finally goes on to say that, to be clear, this is not the only example of the defendant pursuing a claim with increasing indignation while simultaneously failing to acknowledge that this court's rulings on those subjects have been repeatedly upheld. In other words, appeals courts, other judges looked to these same kinds of things and said, nope, the trial court has gotten it just right. Here, the impact of dismissal on the safety or welfare of the community would be profound, but in the wrong direction, and says, no, we need to do this because the rule of law commands that. To be clear, none of the concerns raised by the Supreme Court in its immunity ruling or referenced by the defendant are relevant to the instant case. And here he's talking once again about the inapplicability of the Supreme Court's decision on July 1, that horrific, unbelievable immunity decision. None of that applies here. Even if you like or dislike that decision, he says, none of that is related to this. Recognizing the magnitude of the unique scenario before us, which is that this particular defendant is about to become the president of the United States of America, the court has scrutinized positions of the respective parties. In doing so, the court recognizes the importance of considering and balancing the seemingly competing factors before it, ensuring that the executive branch is free to fully dispense the duties of the presidency and safeguard the interests of the nation unencumbered by pending criminal proceedings. So he says, I recognize you're about to become the chief executive of our nation. But he says the court is simply not persuaded that any of this outweighs the other factors at this stage in the proceeding. To dismiss the indictment and set aside the jury verdict would not serve the concerns set forth by the Supreme Court in those cases. Presidential immunity, nor would it serve any other concerns under the rule of law. On the contrary, he says, the decision would undermine the rule of law in immeasurable ways, just as this court finds that the president-elect the defendant, that immunity is not an actual precept and one which this court has authority to create. So too does this court find the defendant's status as president-elect does not require the drastic and rare application of its authority to grant the motion in furtherance of justice. This is a rebuke. This is a strong and unmistakable rebuke. As a result of this, he says, to bring this matter to finality, I'm scheduling a sentencing. Along the way, interestingly, he says, well, this court, as a matter of law, must not make any determinations on sentencing prior to giving the parties the opportunity to be heard, which he'll do on January 10th. It seems proper at this juncture to make known the court's inclination not to impose any sentence of incarceration, a sentence that's authorized by the conviction, but one the people concede they no longer view as a practical recommendation. Balancing all these considerations, he goes on to say, a sentence of unconditional discharge appears to be the most viable solution to ensure finality and allow the defendant to pursue his appellate options. As we continue, I'll tell you more about what that means and what we can anticipate this coming week, at the end of this coming week, in the wake of Judge Mershon's very telling, very condemning order as to Donald Trump, defendant appearing before him in just a few days. Continued that discussion on here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, home of the Chad Holmes Show.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. My savings tip for today is about meal planning. I know you've heard of it, but let's talk about it. Meal planning will save you money, it reduces impulse purchases, helps you not waste food, and it may be the very best thing you can do to cut back on your weekly spending. It also helps cut back the number of arguments we have in my house about what's for dinner. A writer of a recent Reader's Digest article said that she saved herself $500 a month on meal planning. I mean, we all eat differently, but those are some real savings. I know, meal planning can be a pain. So I reward myself with a treat while I plan. A beer, some ice cream, maybe a recipe magazine. And in my house, the planner does not have to be the shopper. That's real motivation. For more everyday money tips, check out workmoney.org. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santol, your host this hour and also next hour as we talk about the incoming president, Donald Trump, who remains to this day and presumably will remain probably to the time of his inauguration on January 20th, a convicted felon, the first time in our nation's history that a convicted felon, presumably a sentenced felon, will raise his right hand and take an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, notwithstanding what Judge Juan Mershon has said about him, the contempt that Donald Trump shows for all things justice related, all things rule of law related. This is a magnum opus of the sort that we have not seen before from Judge or Justice Mershon, as they call the judges there at the trial court level. He is condemning Donald Trump for the behavior in which he engaged, but nonetheless scheduling a sentencing for this coming Friday and signaling to the parties, which is unusual to say the least, that he is not going to impose a sentence of incarceration. He plainly has the capacity to do that. An awful lot of analysis being done right now. New York Times, for example, has reviewed 30 felony false records convictions and revealed that no other defendant has received an unconditional discharge of the sort that Juan Mershon is intending to impose here. They instead receive jail, prison sentences, probation, conditional discharges, community service, or fines. Something is usually imposed, and therefore also underscoring the extraordinary nature of the disposition of this case in front of Juan Mershon. Now, what is an unconditional discharge all about? Well, the positive thing about that is it would cement Donald Trump's status as a felon. Again, just weeks before his inauguration. That is important to the rule of law, regardless of what you think about the incoming president. He would be first to carry that designation into the presidency, even as the consequences of that are quite limited. Unlike a conditional discharge, which has conditions on it, that allows a defendant to walk free if they meet certain requirements, some things attendant upon the judgment, such as maintaining employment or paying restitution, those kinds of things. an unconditional discharge would come without any other strings attached, aside from the significant one that in the books of history, Donald Trump would remain a convicted felon. Now, that also gives rise to one other aspect of this, which is, although this happened late this past week, entirely possible that Donald Trump's lawyers who know where the courtroom deputies are, they know where the clerks of court are, could very well file yet another petition with an appellate court to seek to stay even what Judge Merchan has scheduled for this coming Friday. Not entirely unlikely that they may do that in the coming days. We'll have to see. Likely, to think that an appellate court would not prevent the normal course of action from going ahead here, which once again is a sentencing proceeding. Again, just 10 days before Donald Trump becomes the 47th president of the United States of America. A stunning and shocking series of events that bring this matter not to complete conclusion. Donald Trump can still obviously appeal things, not so much related to the sentence. There's very little sentence there to be imposed, but he can appeal, again, his finding of guilt by the jury. That kind of thing can be reviewed by the Court of Appeals there in New York and up to the New York Supreme Court as well. All of that, as I've said before, can happen while Donald Trump assumes the presidency and does the other things that would not in any way be obstructed or stymied by an appellate proceeding going forward. It is good that Juan Merchan, the trial judge here, is now proceeding with this to bring this to conclusion. That's the way it works in America. And to the extent that we still have some sense that no one is above the law, although once again it certainly becomes increasingly clear that at least one person is above the law in America, and his name is Donald Trump. Even as we continue to hold on to that notion, we should continue to abide by these fundamental processes. The sentencing of Donald Trump should go ahead this coming week, and it is good for Juan Merchan to pursue that in the days just ahead. We've got some other news, of course, coming out of courts in America, and this one comes from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. This federal appeals court striking down, saying cannot do this, Federal Communications Commission, a landmark net neutrality rule that basically ends a nearly two-decade effort to regulate what are called broadband internet providers as utilities. Now, there's a whole lot more behind that, which we'll discuss. This is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. It is one of the many appeals courts that's right below the United States Supreme Court. They meet in Cincinnati, Ohio. There's all kinds of states just to the east of us, including Michigan and obviously Ohio to the south, said that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, lacks the authority to reinstate rules that prevented broadband providers from slowing or blocking access to internet contact. Again, this notion of net neutrality giving access to these broadband provider platforms to a broad audience out there. That was the purpose behind this. That was the advocacy advanced by the Biden administration. A three-judge panel coming out of that Sixth Circuit pointed to the Supreme Court decision that we've talked a lot about here on our broadcast, Loper Bright Enterprises. And what did that case do, the Supreme Court? The second most significant case coming out of the Supreme Court. Here it is. Here's the invocation of it. Overturning Chevron, that 1984 legal precedent that said that, you know what, federal courts should defer to the reasonable expertise, the experience, the background of people inside agencies who know what they're doing, giving deference, Chevron deference, to government agencies on regulations. Here, the court revels in adopting the Supreme Court's rejection of that deference and saying applying Loper Bright means we can end the Federal Communication Commission's vacillations, go on to say, and we can basically put an end to the Biden administration's hallmark tech policy, which, again, as we all know, has drawn support from consumer groups and tech giants like Google. Also, of course, some fierce protests from telecommunications giants. Those include people and entities like Comcast and AT&T. The FCC had voted in April to restore net neutrality regulations, expanding government oversight of these broadband providers, aiming to protect consumer access. This is a consumer access rule on the internet. They were first put in place about a decade ago under the Obama administration, aimed at preventing internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast and others from blocking or in some way degrading the delivery of services from competitors like Netflix and YouTube. The rules were appealed under Donald Trump in his first administration and reinstated under the Biden administration. The decision by the Sixth Circuit effectively moves this back and forth battle back into the Trump side of things. And as a result, again, we may well hear more about this. Interesting to speculate about whether or not there should be a further appeal of this in the remaining days of the Biden administration. As we come back, we'll talk more about what that means and about other issues in the rule of law in the United States and across the planet here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio WXCO, home of the big high school sports show.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I am live from Madison and welcome singer-songwriter Katie Scullin into the studio. Then Matt Miller and I discuss award season and 2025 upcoming movies. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio. WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. The latest information on the New Year's attack in New Orleans includes the revelation that the man who carried it out apparently scouted the area and documented what he saw weeks ahead of time. FBI Special Agent Lionel Merthel.
Jabbar made at least two trips to New Orleans in the months prior to the attacks. One in October and the other a month later. In November of 2024.
Merthel says Shamsuddin Jabbar used hands-free glasses to record video as he rode a bicycle through Bourbon Street. President Biden is due in New Orleans tomorrow. He'll talk with family members of those who were killed. Kansas City is among many areas in the middle of a huge snow and ice storm that now extends to the Appalachians. KCTV's Mark Paulos.
We're seeing trucks, four-wheel drive trucks, spinning out. We've seen cars spin out, going the other way, the wrong direction on the highway. These roads, super slick.
Some